just about time to begin. Welcome, everyone. We're so glad to have you join us for this evening's Maven webinar. We're delighted to have our guest speaker tonight. My name is Christine Shupla. I'm from the Lunar and Planetary Institute, and I'm honored to be on the Maven Communication and Public Engagement team. And with me, Tom Mason is our Public Engagement Lead. He's also helping to facilitate this whole program, and he will be appearing periodically. He and I will be happy to answer your comments in the chat box or to bring them to the attention of our presenter tonight. Tonight's presenter is Catherine Kredke. She is joining us from the Southwest Research Institute, where she studies planetary formation. She's been studying protosolar nebula and how it forms planets, how the planets forms and the structure of these planets and how that structure impacts the abundance of the planets and where they wind up in the solar system, how they affect other planets around them and objects. So we're really delighted to have her here with us. Catherine, anytime you are ready to begin.
Okay, if I will attempt to... Oh, I think I need to be made host in order to be able to share my screen.
Okay, we will make sure that you are the host here.
Wonderful.
And we're having a slight technical issue for some of you on the telephone. We'll try to get that fixed immediately.
Okay. So, can people see my screen now?
Yes, I can see it. Fine, okay. Catherine.
Okay. Wonderful. Okay, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to get to talk to you a little bit about planet formation and specifically about forming Mars. So, I understand this is a little bit different type of talk than many of the talks that have gone on in this session. So, do feel free to ask questions as we go along, and I will be, I'm very happy to stop and make sure that everyone understands what's going on. So my work is mostly, on planet formation in general, not specifically studying Mars, but it turns out that Mars is actually a really interesting planet for trying to understand how planets formed in our own solar system. So here's the solar system that I'm sure all of you are quite familiar with. We've got all of our planets on top. On the plot below, shows the all of the, both the planets and the dwarf planets in our solar system. So in the inside, there's the four terrestrial planets, then Ceres there, the biggest object in the asteroid belt. And then the four giant outer planets with a population of Kuiper belt bodies, including the four recognized Vander planets, Pluto, Haumea, Makemake, and Aries in the outer solar system. And so when we're trying to understand planet formation, it really is trying to understand this entire process, how you make an entire system like this all together. But for this topic here, we're going to focus specifically on forming those four terrestrial planets. Although, as you'll see, it's quite possible that Jupiter and Saturn, are the big giants of our solar system, are a really important part of the story as well. The earliest stages of planet formation are really the end stages of star formation. So if you imagine a giant molecular cloud starts collapsing down, and in the middle of it, you form the central protostar, the protosun. But because there's a little bit of angular momentum in that cloud, as it collapses down, you end up with this disk around it. If anyone's been watching the Olympics, you nicely see how angular momentum works with the ice skaters pulling in their arms and spinning faster. So that same thing happens with this collapsing cloud. It collapses down and starts spinning and forms a disk. On the left here, we see two very beautiful artist conceptions of what these protoplanetary disks might look like. But what's really exciting to me is on the right, we see real data, real actual images of these disks. And so you can see that they are very dusty disks. So it's a gas disk with a lot of dust in it. You can't actually see what's going on in the middle of it in the visible light image. You can only see kind of on the top and bottom of this. There's reflective light, central star. But if you look down at this ulna images, so this is a millimeter image, so it's looking at very, you know, long wavelengths of light compared to the visible light, and it's actually able to make it out from the midplane of the disk. And you can see all of these really interesting structures, these rings that are forming very, very early on in the solar system. And these are some of the only types of hints that we have about how planet formation is actually occurring. Unfortunately, for most of the planet formation modeling, even though we have this amazing data, we can't actually observe the sizes that are the most interesting for understanding planet formation. We can observe dust. In the submillimeter, we can observe up to kind of, you know, millimeter particles, maybe centimeter-sized particles. But then, observationally, we kind of go blank, and we can't see what's going on again until we make it up at least in other solar systems, until we really get up to relatively large planet sizes. In our own solar system, of course, we have access to the asteroids and other small bodies, which can be serve as important hints of what's going on. So in general, the process of planet formation is this amazing growth process, which involves, you know, something like, you know, 40 orders of magnitude in mass growth, starting from these very small dust grains that we see in the interstellar medium, so submicron-sized dust. Somehow that micron-sized dust has to coagulate together into larger objects. Here I have a picture of some asteroids in the asteroid belt, which are roughly the right size for what we think, what we call planetesimals. So these are objects maybe kilometers, tens of kilometers, 100 kilometers in size, the dust has to grow into these planetesimals. And I could give an entire talk on all of the ideas on how you actually grow dust grains up to these planetesimal sizes. But for this talk, we'll just assume somehow that happens. And we'll focus on how you assemble these planetesimals, these asteroid-sized bodies, into making the planets in our solar system. Specifically here, we'll focus on how you make the terrestrial planets, which in some ways is a little bit easier. All of the materials that you need to form the terrestrial planets are already available in the planetesimals. If you're trying to form the gas giants, like Jupiter here, a beautiful Juno picture of Jupiter, then you need an additional ingredient. Jupiter is made mostly of hydrogen and helium. So it's actually a more challenging process to explain how the gas giants form. But here we're focusing on Mars. So how do we get from these tens of kilometers, hundreds of kilometers sized planetesimals up to Mars? So I'll be showing a bunch of these plots, basically showing the semi-major axis versus the eccentricity, with a bunch of little bouncing balls representing the planetesimals that are the building blocks of the planetary systems that we have here. So just in case not everybody here is incredibly familiar with this terminology, whenever an object is going around the sun, it tries to go around on what's known as a Keplerian orbit. So these orbits, if they're bound orbits, then they are ellipses. So the semi-major axis is shown in this image here, but basically it's, you can kind of think of it as the average distance that the object is away from the sun. And then the eccentricity of the orbit says how far that orbit deviates from circular. So now the red here shows a circular orbit. This has zero eccentricity. The blue ellipse here has approximately around a 0.7 eccentricity. So eccentricity goes from starts from zero for circular, and if you ended up with a, you know, extremely, extremely narrow ellipse, then you're approaching one. You can actually have eccentricities over one, but those are no longer bound orbits. So for the most part here, you're going to be seeing plots that have eccentricity ranging from zero up until one. Okay. So now the next, here's the first movie for those of you looking at the downloaded presentation. And so this is just showing what happens when you place a population of planetesimals down, starting from around 0.5 AU up until, I think 4 AU is where, a little bit beyond 4 AU in the simulation. In the outer region of this plot, Jupiter is visible. So this is all in the presence of Jupiter. And then Saturn is actually also in this simulation, but not shown here. So as, you know, just due to the different planets and embryos interacting with one another, they start scattering each other. And that increases their eccentricity. They get on these orbits that then can cross each other. They collide and grow. So you can see as the points are growing in size in this simulation, just representing how the different bodies are collecting together to form the form the terrestrial planets. You might have noticed that the colors of these dots were changing a bit. This particular movie scales the based on the initial position in the disk. They assume a different composition of the planets, so you can kind of track what the planets, what the final composition of the planets will be at the end based on what material they accreted. But, you know, in general, this is how most terrestrial planet studies look at it. You start out with some population of planetesimals, you evolve them over, you know, a few hundred million years, and in the end, you'll end up with a planetary system. So pretty straightforward. But it turns out that there are, that these simulations show that there are some problems. And one of the most important is Mars. So, this figure here, the black squares show the position and mass of the four terrestrial planets. And all of the little gray dots show simulated planets from one of these simulations, such as the one I just showed you. The horizontal bars in these simulations, in this plot, aren't error bars. They're actually indications of the eccentricity. So basically, they're showing the farthest in location that the simulated planet goes and the outermost location. So it's perihelion and it's aphelion. And so if you notice in this, where these dots are, there's, you know, maybe quite a few dots generally in the location of Venus and the Earth. But when you look out to where Mars is, most of the dots are significantly more massive than Mars actually is. In kind of a standard simulation, if you just place down a population of planetesimals and allow them to grow, you'll quite often end up with a Mars which is more massive than Earth, while in fact, Mars is only a tenth of the mass of Earth. So this has been one of the huge problems in terrestrial planet formation. Why is Mars so small? Now, some people have argued that, well, if you run enough simulations of terrestrial planet formation, then occasionally you'll end up with a low mass of Mars. So you start out with the same type of simulation that I showed and just run it, you know, 100 times with small variations in the initial condition, then occasionally you'll end up with an embryo at the end that didn't end up colliding with anything. I've used the term embryo a few times, so just to define it, oftentimes people refer to kind of the protoplanets, the planetary, you know, the relatively large planetary building blocks as embryos. So sometimes in some of these simulations, you'll end up with kind of a stranded embryo that doesn't really collide with much, and that can end up being your Mars analog. But it doesn't happen very often. And oftentimes when it does happen, there's other things in the system that don't look like right. Maybe the asteroid belt doesn't have enough mass in it or has too much mass in it. So it's a little bit unsatisfying to just say, we don't, you know, it was just a coincidence that we ended up with a small Mars. Almost 10 years ago now, Brad Hansen did, you know, a rather simple experiment. He said, well, what happens if instead of assuming that your planetesimals, your planetary building blocks, were, you know, uniformly distributed within the inner solar system? What happens if they're only located within a narrow range? So they're only located with this in this range from 0.7 to 1 AU. Now, you do the same type of simulation that we just saw. So you start out with these embryos and planetesimals, allow them to interact with each other, scatter, collide, and grow, and you'll end up with a distribution of planets that's shown here. So the black dots here are our solar system, and the open circles are all of the simulated planets. And you notice this looks a lot better. So basically what's happening in these simulations is since all of the material initially is in this 0.7 to 1 AU region, that's also where most of the growth occurs. But a few of the initial objects are then scattered both inwards and outwards. And the inwards ones might form a nice, you know, Mercury analog. And the ones that are scattered outwards form a nice Mars analog. So that's nice. It gives a fairly good idea of what could be going on, or, you know, it works. Unfortunately, it's not particularly physically motivated. You know, why on earth should there only be these planetesimals in this narrow annulus to begin with? So this led to a number of people trying to come up with ways where you would end up with, you know, how would you create this annulus to start with? Some ideas are, you know, have been around the gaseous protoplanetary disk. So one of the things that happens when you have this gas-rich protoplanetary disk, light from both the central stars and from other stars can end up photoevaporating parts of it away. And some people have argued that maybe you might, the certain wavelengths of light might preferentially remove material in kind of the region where the asteroid belt currently is today, where Mars and the asteroid belt are today. So if you start out with an assumption that your disk has a divot in mass at the location of Mars and the asteroid belt, then you do the same sorts of simulations, you watch the system evolve, and in the end you'll end up, not surprisingly, with, you know, relatively low mass Mars. So that's one way you could do it. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of evidence that photoevaporation really works that way to remove material right in the location we need it at the times that we need it to be removed. Another idea that I've actually worked on a bit is that maybe we're misunderstanding planet formation. So this is a little bit of an aside for this talk here. So if people are interested, I'm happy to talk more at the end of the talk. But particularly to solve some problems in giant planet formation, it's been hypothesized that maybe it's a lot of the growth of planets, you know, especially in the outer solar system and maybe in the terrestrial planet region, happen not from these planetesimals colliding and growing with each other, but with planetesimals accreting a number of small pebbles more around, you know, centimeter size objects. And these small pebbles behave in kind of weird ways in disks. They tend to drift inwards and then can be relatively efficiently accreted by planetesimals. So if you start out with a population of planetesimals as shown here, this is the second movie, then you can see pebbles drifting inwards on the bottom of the plot. They drift inwards, they're accreted by the planetesimals, and which causes the planetesimals to grow, and you end up with a majority of, it just turns out that you end up with the majority of growth happening on the inside, and then after you cause the system to evolve, you end up with relatively, you know, fairly good Earth-Venus analogs with low-mass Mars. There are some other reasons why pebble accretion might not work as well in the inner solar system as it does in the outer solar system, but potentially this is a way you could get a low-mass Mars. But one of the most intriguing ways to do this, and there's been a lot of work done over the past few years, is that maybe it was Jupiter and Saturn moved around and ended up carving up the inner solar system and forming a low mass Mars. So I'm going to take a step back here and describe a little bit about some reasons why planets might move around in the gaseous disk. So this is the next movie here. Is a top-down view of a disk, of a gaseous disk. So the sun is in the center, and in orange around, you're seeing kind of the surface density of the disk. In the left-hand corner, there's a plot showing the surface density of the disk. Right now, it's just decreases as you move away from the sun. So if you place a planet, a small planet in this disk, then you'll start seeing, so this planet is being placed in and then the planet is growing. So you start seeing these spiral arms forming in the disk. So this is due to a tidal interaction between the planet and the gas disk around it. And these beautiful spirals start developing as the planet grows and gets larger and larger. It then actually opens up this nice gap in the disk while still exciting these spiral arms. As an aside, in that earlier picture I showed of the ring structures in the very young protoplanetary disk, one of the ideas of what you might be seeing in there, instead of having multiple planets or something like that, is that these, you're seeing one planet exciting wakes like this that then are interacting with the dust to make those rings. So we think that this really does happen in disks. And as the planet is interacting with this disk, is exciting these spiral arms in the disk, the spiral arms also start torquing the planet. And this causes the planet to start moving. So when a planet is very small, actually one of the huge problems with forming giant planets is that when you end up, so when a planet is small from a giant planet standpoint, but large compared to Mars. So really once you start getting up to maybe Earth size or a few Earth sizes, then you can end up with having this tidal interaction causes the planets to migrate inwards very rapidly. Then as a giant planet grows even bigger, as it starts becoming Saturn size or so, it starts opening up this gap in the disk, and it migrates in more slowly then, but it still migrates inwards. So one of the big problems for forming giant planets has always been, why on Earth are Jupiter and Saturn so far away from the Sun, when if you imagine that they would form, they would feel this tidal interaction with the disk, which would start driving them inwards, you might expect them to all be really close into the star. And in fact, when we look at extrasolar planets, we do see a number of Jupiter-type planets on very short period orbits. So it seems like maybe that does happen in some cases, but it didn't seem to happen here.
Can I pause you right now for just a second, Dr. Kratky? We had one question about, so the interaction that you were describing with the dust and the waves, someone wanted to know if there's a relationship between this and how spiral galaxies form.
So spiral galaxies are, so they... they're a little bit different. So you end up with having, some things are related. So that in general, the fact that you end up with these spiral structures is due to the fact that you have this differential rotation. So in the inside of both the disk and the galaxies, things go a little bit faster. So you can end up with these, when you calculate how, you know, a planet in this case or a giant molecular cloud in the galactic place interact with the rest material around them, that is part of the reason why you get these spiral structures. And actually, there are some beautiful images of a protoplanetary disk with a binary star around it, where there's the spiral wave formed from an interaction with the binary star that then look quite a lot like some galactic pictures, where you have a central galaxy and then another smaller galaxy going around it, which can also excite spiral waves in the same way. So a lot of the same physics is involved, but it is a little bit different in this case because the gas here is very collisional. Everything's, you know, all of the different molecules are colliding into each other all the time, while in a galactic sense, the stars are not actually colliding with each other. They're so tiny that they're just gravitationally interacting with each other. So a little bit of the same process is involved, but also a little bit different. If that's clear.
Thank you.
So if we start, so this problem of migration, that if you stick a Jupiter, you know, if you try to grow a Jupiter in the outer solar system, that it might migrate inwards, you know, before we have a chance to form the terrestrial planets. And, you know, it would kind of be a problem for forming all the terrestrial planets if Jupiter went creaming through the inner solar system. So this led to, I didn't have the dates here. This is over 10 years ago now, I believe, but I didn't write the date. So a couple of people worked out the idea that it might actually be that there's this possibility, because of the properties of Jupiter and Saturn, that we could potentially save the migrating giant planets because of an interaction between the two of them. So this plot is showing the distance of the giant planets to the sun as a function of time. And there's a lot of curves on here, so I'll highlight a couple. So this red curve down here, this curve I highlighted red, shows what happens if you just have Jupiter alone in the disk. So it will migrate inwards with time. But if now, it turns out that if you have Jupiter form, so in the purple curve shows if you have Jupiter form and then Saturn initially is small, so it migrates in very rapidly at the beginning of the year, and then catches up with Jupiter, and then they open up a common gap. And this common gap has this very funky structure, but the end result of it is that it changes this tidal interaction with the disk. So now, instead of trying to push the planets inwards, once Jupiter and Saturn get in this special position relative to one another, then they become residently locked with each other. So they're going around in kind of integer multiples of each other's orbits. And they open up this strange gap that causes the planets to start, that causes the torques on the planet to change direction, and they actually start migrating outwards with time. So this is something that you wouldn't get for any ratio of planets, but it happens to work quite well for something that's around Jupiter's mass with something around Saturn's mass outside of it. So that's pretty neat. Maybe that explains why our system, why we don't have a hot Jupiter in our system, why Saturn and Jupiter instead are in the outer solar system like we see them today. Okay, so you might be thinking, this is very nice, Catherine, but why on earth are you telling me this when we're talking about Mars? So here's the next movie shows Jupiter migrating inwards, then Saturn grows to the point where it then migrates inwards very, very quickly. And around the rest of this, you're seeing some initial planetesimals just left elsewhere in the disk. So the blue ones are initially farther from the solar system, while the red ones are inside of it. So you can see Jupiter and Saturn here end up moving very far into the inner solar system in this model. Then, just as I showed earlier, they get in this resonant configuration. They change the profile of the gas disk, which means that now the migration can turn around and move outwards. So for the next movie shows that migration moving outwards, and they travel back out into the outer solar system, scattering all of these planetesimals as they go. So as you can imagine, this process, if this actually happened, would have a huge impact on what's going on in the terrestrial planet region. And this model was called the Grand Tack. So if any of you are, familiar with boats, tacking is when you go and change direction. So here in this process, giant planets are migrating inwards. They migrate in to about 1.5 AU in this model, change direction, and migrate out. The next movie is an overhead view of this process, just to give another picture of what's going on here. So here we're looking at the circles are showing the orbits of the planets. The dashed circles show the position of the current asteroid belt. So you can see Jupiter migrates inwards, Saturn grows till it's big enough that it can migrate inwards rapidly, catches up to Jupiter, and then they all migrate outward together.
We've got a couple questions here now.
Okay.
The first one was sort of still related to some of these different processes in general, and asked whether the study and analysis of Cassini data of Saturn's rings and their interaction with the moons perhaps provide any insight into planetary formation and migration.
Yeah, so in one of the interesting things is in Saturn's moons, they see these little propeller features, which look quite a lot like an embedded protoplanet interacting with the gas disk. But here it's a little, you know, clump of, you know, not quite a moonlet, but a larger clump of material embedded inside of Saturn's rings, and people can actually see those moving around in the disk. So Saturn's rings have been a really nice, again, it's slightly different physics, or just because of the collisional environment is a little bit different again, but it's very, very analogous. So it's been really neat to see a lot of the things that people have modeled should exist in these type of thin disks for many years, and then actually seeing the propellers says, like, yes, they really do happen.
Awesome. The other question is whether these analyses include the impacts of Uranus and Neptune.
So Uranus and Neptune has been included in some of these simulations. In general, they don't make much of a difference. So their main role is to, if there are more planetesimals out in those regions, then they'll scatter them inwards. But they're small enough compared to Jupiter and Saturn that they really don't have much of an effect on what's going on in the inner solar system.
Thank you.
Okay. Awesome. Okay, so now the next movie is just another close view of really what's happening in the terrestrial planet region. So I'll just restart that. So here, the simulations involve starting with a population of the green parts as the larger embryos, and then some red being the smaller planetesimals. Jupiter moves inwards, tacks at about 1.5 AU, and moves outwards again. And you can see the leftovers look a lot like that kind of cartoon narrow annulus that was described, that Hansen described, you know, almost 10 years ago. So unsurprisingly, if you go to the next movie, then this continues the evolution of those systems. You will wait for the gas disk to go away. So in order for the grand tack to happen, you need the gas disk around. But while the gas disk is around, it keeps all of the planets very low eccentricity. So you need to wait for the gas to go away, and then the planets can interact with it. The embryos can interact with each one another and form the terrestrial planet system. And so this is a nice way, again, to get, you know, some fairly reasonable Venus and Earth analogs and a low-mass Mars. So, yay, now we have a model which is, you know, reasonably motivated, that can explain the low mass of Mars, but it involves the giant planets doing this kind of crazy movement inside and outwards again. So is this right? Does this tell us anything else about planets that, you know, we can test? And one of the most important things that we can test about the planets is, you know, what they're made of. One of the great things about Mars is that we have samples of it. So we can take, you know, Martian meteorites, when objects have hit Mars, they have knocked off rocks from the surface of Mars. They spend, you know, a few million years out in the solar system, and then they come careening down to Earth, and they exist in our meteoritic samples. And so people can go into labs and actually test them and look at them and see what Martian material is made out of. And so on the top of this slide here, I just have a little bit about some nomenclature about how when cosmochemists talk about composition, oftentimes they use these notations, these delta and epsilon notations here, which is really just you take some sample and you compare it to some standard a ratio and then multiply it by some rather large number because we're looking at very small differences between the element ratios in the sample versus the standards. But for the purposes here, it's just small measurements of differences in the isotopic compositions of different objects. And at the bottom here, I have some of the three major types of objects in the asteroid belt that we have in our meteoritic sample. So I'm thoroughly not convinced we have a sample of all planet-forming material in our meteoritic collection. We do have a nice variety of things. So enstatite chondrites are the least volatile rich of chondrites that we have, of pieces of asteroids that we have in our meteoritic collection. Then if you move out to have slightly more volatile or ordinary chondrites, and then even more volatile rich are the carbonaceous chondrites. So you can basically think that probably in our solar system, because the sun, because the protostellar disk probably was warmer in the inner regions than the outer regions, so you would have less water in the inner regions than you do in the outer regions. So this going from enstatite to ordinary to carbonaceous chondrites is probably probing heliocentric distance from the star. So the enstatite chondrites probably form farther inwards, and then the ordinary chondrites, and then the carbonaceous chondrites.
Another question. So for the different, for where the different chondrites or where the different rocks and meteorites have come from, one of our participants wanted to know, how do we know which ones came from Mars, for instance?
So we can look at the spectral type. We can look at the rock and look at what does, now that we've actually even been to Mars, we can look at them and we can say, are the types of minerals that we see in the rock, do they look like they're consistent with what we see on Mars? These pictures here are all these primitive asteroids, so we can tell that they are from bodies that never formed cores. So like the Earth and Mars all formed cores. We have iron-rich cores, and so our mantles have a very specific composition. So you can tell by looking at a rock whether or not that body that it was on had formed a core or not based on the composition. So we've seen these rocks in the samples that looked like they were representing the mantle of a rather large body, but they don't have the same composition of Earth. And then after we got more data about what Mars looks like, it turns out that they do appear to be very similar to Mars. So you can be pretty confident that those are indeed samples of Mars. There have been a lot more controversy over, there's been a rock that was claimed to maybe be a Mercury meteorite, but that's been a lot harder to demonstrate, that we have, whether or not that really might have come from Mercury or not. But for the Martian ones, we can be pretty confident.
Thank you.
Right. So now here's one of these isotopic diagrams. So we're just looking at different amounts of silicon and oxygen isotopes here, and Earth generally is going to lie at 0, 0 on these plots because Earth is normally the standard that all of these are compared to. But we can see a lot of these different bodies here. And so when you look at it, these carbonaceous chondrites tend to kind of cluster in the same regions. Enstatite chondrites, as you see, kind of cluster in one place. The HED ones, these actually are from the mantle of Vesta, we believe, that kind of land in a certain region, and Mars, and the ordinary chondrites. And so you can see from this that Martian rocks really do look quite different from Earth rocks. So that's how we, that's one of the indications, you know, when people first looked at these, that this is not, you know, just a piece of Earth we're looking at. It's from something a bit different. And this is true, you know, not only for these couple of ones, you can take a look at a whole slew of different isotopes. Oh, I'm cut off a bit on the bottom there. But the main picture is that Mars is generally quite different from the Earth, but it oftentimes ends up being relatively similar to the ordinary chondrites. If you look at all these plots, the Mars points are most of the time pretty close to these OC points, the ordinary chondrites.
And so the next question is related to that. And since they're all from the same accretion disk, why don't the Earth rocks have similar compositions to the asteroids and Mars meteorites? Why are they so different?
So one is that these differences are really quite small. So if you remember the delta epsilon notations, you were multiplying by 1,000 or 10,000 or to see these differences. But at a really fundamental level, we don't know why there are these differences in the disk. Some of them, like oxygen, we think might have to do with a kind of a complex chemistry going on in the disk. So different amounts of when you start freezing out water into water ice, so you start trapping a bunch of oxygen in there, that you preferentially start sealing away the heavier oxygen before you seal away the lighter oxygen. The lighter oxygen has a little bit easier time escaping. So you could end up having different chemistry based on where you are in the disk. But at a fundamental level, a lot of these isotopic differences we don't understand the source of. We just observe that there are these differences, and then we try to use the fact that there are all these differences to infer something about where things formed within the disk. But, you know, for instance, if you look at this chromium diagram here, I told you that I thought that we generally think that enstatite chondrites formed relatively close into the sun, ordinary chondrites formed farther out, and then carbonaceous chondrites formed even farther out. But it's not like there's a line here. So it's a very complicated process going on, which is causing these chemical differences. But they do appear on at least some level to be there.
Thank you.
So because of these differences, and if it looks like it's true that Mars formed more in the region of the ordinary chondrites than the Earth did, then we can take these planet formation simulations and look at them and see where did the initial body, when we can take the final planets formed and say, where was the material that formed those planets found? And so here's a plot from the some Grantax simulations. And the error bars here are showing the range of semi-major axis of incorporated materials. And you can see that in the inner regions, generally you're grabbing from, you know, kind of this whole, you know, 0.7 to around, you know, beyond to maybe 1.7 region. But as you move outwards, there are a few bodies, you end up with this kind of bifurcation here, where some bodies end up being formed from the same region as the Earth did, but other ones started forming from farther out in the disk. So here's some kind of complicated plot here, but showing the results of a simulation in which all of the planets ended up with very similar compositions. So this upper panel here, the lines are showing kind of the position of your planet as a function of time, while the points are showing the initial position and size of an object which was then accreted by those planets at the time that they were accreted. So in this simulation, pretty much everything was accreted from approximately the same regions in the disk, and so you ended up with kind of the same compositions at the end. However, here's a model where as Jupiter was going inwards and outwards, it actually scattered something that initially was out, you know, well in the current present day asteroid belt. All of these jumps in its semi-major axis here are it interacting with Jupiter. So here this planet was scattered around and accreted basically all of its material in the outer solar system, or in the asteroid belt region, while the terrestrial planets, while the other terrestrial planets, all accreted most of the material in the inner region. And that leads to a composition where Mercury, Venus, and Earth all have relatively similar compositions. In this particular simulation, there was an impact from a fairly distant object onto the Earth, which caused this carbonaceous quadrate signature in it. But Mars, on the other hand, was mostly accreted its material in the outer regions. So it could very well be that these differences that we're seeing between the composition of Earth and the composition of Mars are showing that Mars was initially farther out from the sun than it is today. And as Jupiter scattered inwards, it threw Mars all around and then implanted it in the current position. So Mars could have initially formed in the asteroid belt. So this is, I think this is a neat idea. It's a pretty cool way to, you know, explain why Mars looks different from the Earth, even though it's not that far away. But I should throw a little bit of a point of caution in here, is that, you know, this is very active research, and not everybody agrees. There's some nice work done a couple of, you know, I guess a year ago, 2 years ago now, which showed that maybe Mars and the Earth really aren't as different as we think that they are. Maybe there were it's just the fact that, you know, Mars is a little bit smaller, and if you do kind of, you know, Monte Carlo simulations of ending up with what you're going to look at when you look at these rocks from the Earth and Mars, maybe Earth and Mars really are more similar than we thought. In which case, that original picture where Earth and Mars accreted from the same area would be fine. This is still very active research.
We have a couple. Could you go back a couple slides to the pie charts?
Yeah.
And one of our participants wants to know a little bit more about the green in the pie charts, what that signifies.
Yes, so the colors here, though, in these simulations, they started out kind of arbitrarily choosing that all material that was in the kind of inner solar system was considered this enstatite material, and was yellow. The green is from material which was more in the central asteroid belt. And then the blue is material that was kind of initially beyond the asteroid belt, kind of more in the outer solar system. So as planet formation occurs, material scatters around a bunch. So all of the planets accrete material from different zones. But in this particular one, the Mars planet most accreted almost all of its material from the asteroid belt region, which is considered to be the ordinary chondrites in this model, and only a little bit of the inner material. While in the previous plot, it was a little bit more uniform.
We have a couple more questions. In the Grand Tac model, with the migration and Mars potentially forming in the asteroid belt, at any point would it have been in a Goldilocks zone?
Well, I mean, in some ways today Mars is in the Goldilocks zone. If Mars was larger and was able to retain more of an atmosphere, it's very possible that you could have liquid water on the surface of Mars now. In most of these models, Mars actually spends more time farther out than it does right now, because if Mars goes farther inwards, it has there probably was a body that was about Mars size that did go inwards into the inner solar system, and that body hit the Earth and was the reason why we have a moon right now. So Mars probably didn't spend too much time much farther inwards than what it is today. And this is all still very, very early on. This is in the first million years, first few million years of the solar system. So probably a bit too early for me to be particularly interesting for life.
We have a couple more questions.
Yeah.
About Mars and magnetic fields. Since Mars doesn't have a coherent global magnetic field right now, could that at all be related to accretion impacts and would Jupiter's magnetic field as Jupiter moved in and out potentially have had any effect on Mars's magnetic field?
Yeah, so the main reason why we think Mars doesn't have a magnetic field today is because it's small enough that it just doesn't retain enough heat to have the liquid core that you really need in order to sustain a global magnetic field. So even though Jupiter has a massive magnetic field compared to, all of the other planets in the solar system, it really isn't big enough to actually affect the magnetic field on another planetary-sized body. Early on, when Mars was hotter and it had, so there was more heat inside of it, so it could have a liquid core, it very well might have had a magnetic field, but it's so small that it lost it pretty quickly.
And then with all of the different models here, how does Mars's density play into these models?
So Mars's density is a little bit, when you make Mars out of slightly different materials, you could change the density a little bit, but all of these different densities, but even though Mars, we're saying, is slightly compositionally different from the Earth, it isn't so different. It's still made up of generally the same stuff. Most of it is silicates plus iron are going to be the bulk things that are determining the density of the planet. So you can end up with the more, as far as planet formation, the more interesting things about density and terrestrial planets is actually happening at the other end of the terrestrial planets with Mars, because there you have Mercury. So it's because something changed Mercury's ratio, big bulk ratio of the amount of silicates versus the amount of iron in Mercury. So the Mercury is a lot denser. With Mars and Earth and Venus, they all look to have about the same amount of those kind of elements, which are generally determining the bulk properties. So Mars's density isn't a big differentiator in the formation processes on this level.
Okay. And we're running out of time. I do have a question that I want to rephrase and ask and then let you finish up your talk. There was a question here about Mars potentially forming, you know, at a greater distance from the sun, how that influences our the evidence that early Mars was warm and wet and being so far from the sun. You know, how could that be? So I guess the question is, about when would it have migrated from way out there with the asteroids in closer?
Yeah, so all of this really crazy stuff is happening while the gas disk was still around, because once Jupiter went in, since the gas was causing Jupiter to move, you need the gas to have all of this happen. And what we observe is that gas disks around other stars generally only live, stay around for, you know, typically 3 million years, although we do see some that are 10 million years or so. So this is all very, very early in the history of the solar system. For example, at these points, when Mars is doing all this moving around, Earth has still not formed yet. Earth is still a number of embryos together that haven't completely gotten there. So there's a hydrogen helium gas around, which is completely changing the environment of Mars. So this is probably not something that is good. It's much later when people start debating about what is the climate on Mars going to be like. Cool.
Thank you.
Okay. So I think given time, I'll just say that the last thing that I wanted to, since all of these have been kind of, you know, ideas that we have about Mars, I won't go too much about explaining how we know this, but one of the things that we do know, which nicely does relate to the timing issue, is by looking at the composition of Mars, by looking at the radioisotopes on Mars, we see that Mars actually must have formed very quickly. So while the Earth probably took tens of millions of years to form, like many people think the moon forming impact, which is kind of the end stage of the Earth formation, was maybe around 60 million years or later. Mars looks like it basically completely formed within, you know, 2 to 5 million years, while the gas disk was still around. So really, Mars actually was there from the very, very earliest stages of our solar system. And that is something that we do actually see in pretty much all of the planet formation models, which I've been showing here. So the final movie, just because, you know, all of these movies are great, just shows how you can start down with a population of planetesimals over a few million years. You start growing up a population. The black dots here show, you know, roughly a whole series of roughly Earth mass planets. And that happens very, very quickly within a few million years. And then after the gas disk goes away, in the inner solar system, these embryos will go unstable and collide with each other and grow. But Mars must be a remnant of these very earliest stage of planets. So it's very neat that we have it around today to study. I'll just end it there and just say that Mars is a really important clue into understanding how our solar system formed. Even though there's still a lot of puzzles that we're trying to work out, planets really do have a tendency to move. So don't make the assumption that any planet formed where we see it now. And as we get more data about both Mars and, you know, about Venus and Mercury, would be wonderful too, to really understand what was the composition of our early solar system was, and put some more constraints on these models. So. Thanks. I think if there's time for some more questions.
If anyone has a burning question or two, we'll take it. But outside of that, it's just about time to go. So any burning questions? Okay, one here. Just a comment. We haven't even tapped into the Kuiper Belt or Oort cloud, so a lot more to cover here.
So much amazing data out there.
Absolutely, absolutely. Any other final questions? Why is Mercury so small?
Yeah, so it really seems like Mercury must be some kind of edge effects that, you know, that for some reason in our solar system, we didn't form it, planetesimals inwards of a certain position. And so then you ended up with kind of this Mercury being scattered out as a runt of the litter. But it is a big puzzle because especially when you look at extrasolar planets, we see a lot of planets, which are quite large, interior to the orbit of Mercury. So there's no reason why we couldn't have formed planets there. So Mercury is another really important puzzle.
Thank you so much for your presentation. We've got lots of people saying this was informative and outstanding. One question about whether InSight is going to affect this at the InSight mission. I'll leave that as the very last question.
Yeah, so InSight should be able to give some interesting seismographic information to try to understand the interior of Mars, which could also help us try to understand the formation of Mars. So that will definitely be useful.
Thank you.
Okay.
Muted and unmuted myself really quickly. Thank you so much for all of your time. Thank you everyone for joining us. Our next MAVEN webinar will be on April 18th, where we're going to explore the relationship between magnetospheres and habitability and whether there is one. This has been recorded and the recording will be online in a couple of days along with more notes. But thank you so much, Dr. Craig. We really appreciate your time tonight.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks everybody. Have a great evening.